I'm Emma Freud. This is my rather noisy kitchen. And sitting in it is David Sedaris. 10 million copies of his books are now in print. His public readings are legendary events. And his brilliant, weird, honest and dark writing has been translated into 29 languages. David's been making programmes for the BBC since the late 90s, first from New York, then from Paris, and in more recent years from London. No one knew back in 1996 just how popular and renowned, both nationally and internationally, David would become. But anyone who heard him then had a feeling they'd stumbled on something very special. We're going to be revisiting some of the greatest moments in David's radio archive that's not had a proper airing since its original transmission, and getting to hear again some of our favourite stories. Tell you a line in The Ramblings that intrigued me. You were talking about the curious fact that you've never seen someone throwing away litter.
Mm-hmm.
You just find the litter, but you've literally never seen someone throwing it away. And Claire asked you what would happen if you did, and you said, well, if it was an old woman or a small child who was throwing away litter, I'd yell at them, but I'm scared of everybody else. Are you really?
Oh, yeah. But since that time, I've seen a couple people litter.
Did you?
And once it was a very fancy woman who picked up after her dog and then threw the bag into bushes. I saw another one a few weeks ago, and she emptied her pockets of trash and kind of threw them at a pile of recycling, which the guys who come to collect the recycling aren't going to pick your tissues up off the street. What bothered me was the look on her face, like, well, that's taken care of. And again, I tell myself that what I could do is pull my notebook out, because I always have a notebook on me, and say, oh my goodness, I'm so glad I saw you do that. I'm writing an article about litter. And could you just tell me why you did that? Because I'm dying to know, because that's not going to be picked up by, you know, you might as well have just thrown that into the street. So why is that okay? Like, how do you feel about that?
Did you do that?
No. No, because I'm afraid of everybody. I mean, if I saw a 5-year-old, I'd probably think, oh, that next time, wait, like, when you're 7, you better not let me catch you do that.
Have you found a dead body yet?
No, and that's my goal, is to find a dead body. I saw the other day, I thought I found a human leg. I was so excited. And it's wrapped up in plastic, but it's a deer's leg. So somebody took a deer's leg and wrapped it up in plastic and threw it into the forest about a mile from my house. And then I thought, okay, well, a fox would probably be pretty happy with that, but the plastic is a problem, you know? So getting the plastic off the maggoty deer leg was not a...
Do you think more...
Not fun.
Do you think more weird things happen to you, or do you just notice them?
Well, again, if you're out there by the side of the road, I mean, most people are in their cars.
But it's not just there, it's everywhere. Your entire life is weird things happening to you.
Yeah, but at the same time, I'm a professional. And so I carry a notebook in my pocket, and I'm always looking for things. And I'm never off, right? I'm never not working in that sense. So if I see or hear something that's remarkable, that's a great day for me.
Okay, we now get to my favourite piece of yours, everybody's favourite piece of yours. We've got to Santa Land. It's Santa Land time, David. Oh, look at that little face. Almost a sneer.
No, oh gosh, no. It's just, you know, I suppose you're lucky if you have something that worked in that regard. And that was the first thing I ever had on the radio.
In America?
In America. And so it really worked. But it doesn't, when I look back over it, I don't know, the writing just seems so choppy to me, and, you know, it's just old.
It certainly served its purpose, because it was the first thing that you broadcast, and after it, your life was really never the same again, was it?
No, it wasn't. This fellow, Ira Glass, in America, put it on a local show he had in Chicago, and then he put it on a national show on National Public Radio that had 10 million listeners. So I think my biggest audience until that point had been 500. But they weren't all coming to see me. It was like 500 people for like a variety show situation.
Where you were reading out pieces.
Yeah, I was reading, but there were other people on the bill. And so I just went right from 500 to 10 million. And it just changed everything for me in the sense of having opportunities. And I'm lucky in that I was 35 at the time. So I think if I'd been 22... I wouldn't have been able to keep my head screwed on.
You know that phrase that people who become famous quickly never age beyond the age that they were when they got famous quickly? Which is why child stars, they say, have so many problems. You know, if you get hugely famous at 13, kind of emotionally, that's where you stay.
Well, I was 35, and I'd been writing every single day for 15 years. And I'd written a lot, and I hadn't had anything published in a magazine that anybody had heard of, and I hadn't had a book published, but I felt like I was ready.
How had you kept your confidence going for 15 years of not being published?
I never associated success as a writer with having things published. I guess I just felt like when the time was right, then somebody would phone and say, can we publish you?
Wow. And that kept you going.
Yeah, and that's what happened. Little Brown phoned and then said, do you have a book we can publish? And I said, I have it right here in a drawer. I've been waiting all my life for you to call. And the New Yorker called and said, would you like to write for us? And I said, I certainly would. So when I was on the radio and I had all those opportunities, I was old enough that I could say, this is what I want. I want to write books and I want to write for the New Yorker. And I very much would like to keep being on the radio, but I don't actually want to write for a soap opera. I don't actually want to write for a sitcom. It's very nice to be asked, but do I really want to do those things? No, I don't.
Do you still feel that way now?
Yeah, I still feel that way.
Like if someone offered you a movie, would you go, I know what I'm good at and it's not movies?
No, I mean, I like going to the movies, but I wouldn't know what to make a movie out of. I wouldn't know... You know, like a novel, there has to be a reason for you to turn from page 378 to 379. And the novelist makes you do that. I have a 12-page attention span. I can make you turn from page 8 to page 9, but you put another digit in front of that, and I don't know how to do it. And maybe I should branch out, and maybe I should try new things, but I don't care enough about them, you know? I mean, there have been times when I've met with people about movie projects, and when I'm with them, you know, I feel excited. But the second we're not together anymore, I don't care about her anymore.
With Santaland, you're in New York, and you're doing many different odd jobs. You're cleaning, you're apple picking, you're caring for a quadriplegic, and then you get a job as an elf. Did you take the job in order to write about it?
No, I just took the job because I had just moved to New York City and I was running out of money, and I'm the world's worst at applying for jobs. And I would say to myself, okay, you're going to go tomorrow and apply for this job. And then I wouldn't. All my life I've been like that. I can't give you one reason to hire me. I can give you 10 reasons not to hire me. But I've never been able to walk into a place and look the person in the eye and say, I think you need me working here. Unable to do it. So, and I saw this job, and they were hiring short people, and I'm short. And I noticed when I just told people I was applying for the job, I noticed how they would laugh. And they're kind of laughing at me, but I've never really drawn that distinction, you know, between people laughing with me and laughing at me. It's still a laugh. So I thought, I might be onto something here. And I wasn't thinking about writing it. I was just thinking, you know, you're at a table with people and you're talking about your work day, and I just would win, you know, in any kind of a situation. Maybe I just wasn't hanging out with the right people. You know, maybe I need to know more emergency room physicians or something.
No, there is no social setting where saying you're an elf does not mean that you win. From 2014, this is the special BBC Radio 4 recording of David Sedaris's Santaland Diaries.
My costume is green. I wear moss-covered velvet breeches, an emerald smock, and a stocking cap decorated with spangles. This is my work uniform. My elf name is Crumpet, and I was allowed to choose it myself, which is something. The Santaland Diaries. In order to land my job at Macy's Santaland, I filled out 10 pages worth of forms, took a multiple choice personality test, submitted urine samples, and underwent 2 interviews. The first one was general, designed to eliminate the sorts of people you don't much want hanging around with children. During the second one, we were asked why we wanted to be elves, which is always a tricky question. I'm certain I failed my drug test. My urine had roaches and stems floating in it, but still they accepted me because I am short. 5 feet, 5 inches. Almost everyone they hired is on the small side. One is a dwarf. After the second interview, I was brought to the manager's office, where I was shown a floor plan and told that on a busy day, as many as 22,000 people might visit Santaland. An elf wears many hats. So before starting, there'll be several days of training. Will that be a problem? I was asked. And strangely excited, I said, no, not at all. Today, we were given presentations and speeches in a windowless conference room crowded with desks and plastic chairs. Interpreters for the deaf came and taught us to sign, Merry Christmas! I am Santa's helper! They taught us to speak as we sign and to employ bold facial expressions. You are a very pretty boy/girl, we were taught to say. I love you. Do you want a surprise? My sister Amy lives above a deaf girl and has learned quite a bit of sign language over the years. She passed some on, and I'm able to say, Santa has a tumor in his head the size of an olive. Maybe it will go away tomorrow, but I don't think so. This morning we were lectured by our managers, most of whom started at the bottom, in uniforms much like my own. I want you to remember that even if you are assigned photo elf on a busy weekend, you are not Santa's slave, one of them said, garnering little nods from her associates. The chief of security lectured us on employee theft, and then, finally, we were given a tour of Santaland, which really is something. A world of wonder with 10,000 sparkling lights, false snow, train sets, bridges, decorated trees, mechanical penguins and bears, and really tall candy canes. Visitors enter and travel a narrow path through a maze. It's one festive sight after another, culminating at the magic tree. Once you pass it, the lights dim, and an elf guides you to one of the many Santa houses, all of which are cozy and intimate, laden with toys. Then you leave and are met with a line of cash registers. Touring the maze for a second time, we were given the code names for various posts, my favorite being the Vomit Corner, a mirrored wall near the magic tree that, for one reason or another, prompts people to throw up. When that happens, the nearest elf is supposed to yell, Vamoose, which is the name of the janitorial product used by the store. On any given day, you can be an entrance elf, a water cooler elf, a bridge elf, train elf, maze elf, island elf, magic window elf, emergency exit elf, counter elf, magic tree elf, pointer elf, Santa elf, photo elf, usher elf, cash register elf, runner elf, or exit elf. We were given a demonstration of the various positions in action performed by returning elves who were so animated it embarrassed me to walk past them. I don't know that I could look someone in the eye and exclaim, Oh my goodness, I think I see Santa. Or, can you close your eyes and make a very special Christmas wish? Everything they said had an exclamation point at the end of it and left me feeling cornered. I'm hoping I can take the enthusiasm down a few notches and just be a low-key sort of elf. Today was our big dress rehearsal. The lockers and changing rooms are located on the 8th floor, directly behind Santaland. Elves have gotten to know one another over the past 4 days of training, but once we took our clothes off and put on the uniforms, everything changed. The woman in charge of costuming assigned us our outfits and gave us a lecture on keeping things clean. "Ladies," she said, holding up a calendar, "you know what this is. Use it. I have scraped enough blood from the crotches of elf breeches to last me the rest of my life, and don't tell me I don't wear underpants. I'm a dancer. If you were a real dancer, you wouldn't be here. You're an elf, and you're going to wear panties like an elf." Today was the official opening day of Santaland, and I worked as a magic window elf, a Santa elf, and an usher elf. The magic window was located in the adult quick peep line. My job was to say, "Step on the magic star, then look through the window and you can see Santa." I was at my post for 15 minutes before a man approached and said, "You look so stupid." "At least I get paid to look stupid," I wanted to say. "You're just giving it away for free." That was out of the question, though. So instead, I said, "Thank you," as if I had misunderstood him and thought he had said, "You look terrific. Thank you." Again this morning, I got stuck at the window. "Step on the magic star and you can see Santa." I said that for a while, and then I changed it to, "Step on the magic star and you can see Cher." Some grown-ups in the other line, the line to sit on Santa's lap, cut through the gate so they could stand on my magic star. A few got angry when they looked through the window and saw Santa rather than Cher, but what did they honestly expect? And as punishment, I was sent to Elf Island, which is excruciating, as all you do is stand around and act merry. This evening, I was sent to be a photo elf, a job I enjoyed the first few times I did it. The camera is hidden in Santa's fireplace, and I take the picture by pressing a button at the end of a cord. The results arrive by mail weeks later, and while there's no way an elf can be identified and held accountable, you still want to make a good photo. The problem is that parents can take pictures as well, and boy, do they. You see them in the maze, loaded down with equipment. "Monica, baby, look at the train set, and then look at me. No, look at me. Now wave. That's right. Wave hard." By the time they reach Santa, they're full-fledged art directors. "All right, Ellen, I want you and Marcus to stand by those presents. And when I say now, I want you to get onto Santa's lap. Look at me now. Look at Daddy until I tell you to look at Santa." Families and groups are even worse. "All right, now let's get a shot of Anthony, Damascus, Teresa, Doug, Amy, Paul, and Vanity. Can we squeeze them all in together? Santa, how about you let Doug get on your shoulders? Can we do that?" Then there's the grooming. It's one thing for a mother to push her child's fringe back, but one this morning arranged her daughter on Santa's lap and then proceeded to spray the kid's hair. Santa treated as though he were a cement prop, turning his head and wincing as the lacquer stung his eyes. Children ages 1 to 4 will more often than not end up crying, and once that happens, it's over. "Maybe we'll try again next year," Santa will say. Most parents, though, are not about to give up that easily. Tonight, I saw a woman slap and shake her sobbing daughter, yelling, "God damn it, Rachel, get back on that man's lap and smile." This afternoon, a man arrived at the magic tree, a sloppy, good-looking fellow in his mid-40s. I reassured him that many adults come to visit Santa. Everyone is welcome. An hour later, I noticed the same guy back for another go. "What do you talk about in there?" I asked. And in a cracked and puny voice, he answered, "Toys." "All the toys." An hour later, he returned again and got so excited, he peed on Santa's lap. That happens from time to time, but usually it's children. Not that it matters, really. Urine. So far in Santaland, I have seen Simone from the soap opera General Hospital, Sean from All My Children, Walter Cronkite, and Phil Collins, who was smaller than I'd imagined and very well groomed. Last year, an elf was suspended after asking Goldie Hawn to autograph her hand. We've been firmly instructed to leave the stars alone. But don't we owe something to the people around us, many of whom are from out of town and need a celebrity sighting in order to round out their New York experience? Look, I whispered to a woman in the maze tonight, there's Phil Collins. It was like giving her a present. I think that might be his daughter with him. The woman was delighted, as were the next dozen or so people I told. Want to see Phil Collins? Look over by those candy canes. Once he entered the magic tree and was no longer visible to the maze audience, I began telling people that if they left immediately and took a right at the end of the hall, they could probably catch up with him after his visit to Santa. So they did. They left. When Phil Collins walked through the exit, there was a crowd of 20 waiting for autographs. The managers came looking for the big mouth, and I said, Phil Collins? Who's he? I was at the magic tree this evening when I saw a woman unzip her son's fly, fish out his penis, and instruct him to pee into a bank of artificial snow. He was young, 4 or 5 years old, and he did it. He peed. Urine dripped from the branches of fake trees and puddled on the floor. Vamoose! A spotted child visited Santa, climbed up onto his lap, and said that by Christmas he hoped to get over the chicken pox. Santa leapt up. The overall cutest elf is a fellow from Queens named Snowball. The guy tends to ham it up a bit, sometimes literally tumbling down the path to the magic tree. That makes me wince, but still, you just want to put him in your pocket. We were working together yesterday afternoon when he turned to me saying, I'd follow you to Santa's house any day, Crumpet. It made me dizzy, this flirtation. At the end of our shift, we were in the restroom changing clothes when suddenly we were surrounded by 3 Santas and 5 other elves, all of them guys that Snowball had been trifling with. Turns out he just leads people on, both elves and Santas. Snowball is playing a dangerous game. This afternoon, I was stuck being photo elf with Santa. I don't know his real name. No one does. During most days, there's a slow period when the two of you sit around the house and talk. Most of them are super nice guys, very warm and open, but Santa takes himself a bit too seriously. Ask him where he lives, meaning Brooklyn or Manhattan, and he'll answer, why, I live at the North Pole with Mrs. Claus. Right, I said, so what do you do the rest of the year? Well, I make toys for all the children. Okay, sure, but what do you do for money? Santa doesn't need money, he told me. Santa sits and waves and jingles his bell sash when no one is there. He recited the night before Christmas, and it was just the two of us in the house. No children, just us. He said, oh, little elf, straighten up those mantle toys for Santa. I reminded him that I have a name, Crumpet. And then I straightened up the stuffed animals. Oh, little elf, bring Santa a throat lozenge. So I brought him one. Santa has an elaborate little act for the children. He talks and chuckles and rings his bells. When he asks them to name their favorite Christmas carol, most of them answer Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Oh, he says, I love that song. Do you think you can sing it for me? The kids are shy, and when they try to back out of it, Santa summons me with a clap. Oh, little elf, help young Brenda to sing that favorite carol of hers. Then I have to stand and sing Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, which I hate, especially when the kids' parents are my age or, even worse, younger. This afternoon I worked as an exit elf, telling people in a loud voice, this way out of Santaland. A mother was standing at one of the cash registers paying for her picture while her son lay beneath her, having a tantrum. Riley, she said, if you don't start behaving yourself, Santa's not going to bring you any of those toys you asked for. The child said, he is too going to bring me toys, liar. He already told me. The woman grabbed my arm. You there, elf. Tell Riley here that if he doesn't start behaving immediately, then Santa's going to change his mind and bring him coal for Christmas. I said that Santa no longer traffics in coal. Instead, if you're bad, he comes to your house and steals things. I told Riley that if he didn't behave himself, Santa was going to take away his TV and all his electrical appliances and leave him in the dark. All your appliances, including the refrigerator. I said, your food is going to spoil and smell bad. It is going to be so cold and dark where you are. Man, Riley, are you ever going to suffer? All right, the woman said, that's enough. I said, he's going to take your car and your furniture and all your towels and blankets and leave you with nothing. The mother said, no, really. That's enough. Lately, I am feeling trollish and have changed my elf name from Crumpet to Blisters. Blisters. I think it's cute. Today, a child told Santa Ken that he wanted his dead father back and a complete set of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Everyone wants those turtles. A child came to Santa this morning and his mother said, all right, Jason, tell Santa what you want. Tell him what you want. Jason said, I want Procter and Gamble to stop animal testing. The mother said, Procter, Jason, that's Procter and Gamble. And what do they do to animals? Do they torture them, Jason? Is that what they do? Jason said, yes, they torture. He was maybe 6 years old. We were packed today, and everyone was cranky. Once a line gets long, we break it up into four different lines because anyone in their right mind would leave if they knew it was going to take over 2 hours to see Santa. 2 hours. You could see a movie in that amount of time. I was sent into the crowded hallway to direct the second phase of the line, and all along the way, people stopped me. Where do I find the down escalator, the patio restaurant, gift wrap, Trimetry? There was a line for the maze entrance and a line for the women's bathroom, and one woman, having already bothered me with three stupid questions, asked, which is the line for the women's bathroom? And I answered that I thought it was the line with all the women in it. And she said, I'm going to have you fired. What's your name? Crumpet. I had two people say that to me today. I'm going to have you fired. And I wanted to lean over and say, I'm going to have you killed. I got stuck with Santa again this afternoon and had to sing and fetch for 3 hours. Late in my shift, the child said she didn't know what her favorite Christmas carol was, but that Away in the Manger was okay, she guessed. Do you think you can sing it for me? Santa asked. When the girl confessed that she didn't know the word, Santa clapped his hands. Oh, little elf, come sing Away in the Manger for us. It didn't seem fair that I should have to solo, so I told him that I didn't know the words either. Oh, of course you do. Come now, sing. So I did it the way Billie Holiday might if she'd put out a Christmas album. Away in a manger. No, crib for bed, the little Lord Jesus lay down his sweet head. Santa did not allow me to finish. I was photo elf tonight for the oldest of the Santas. Usually their names are scribbled on the water cups they keep hidden on the toy shelf, but this one had no writing on it, and we were too busy for introductions. One group would leave, and sensing another right behind them, he would begin to sing, A pretty girl is like a melody. The parents and children would enter the room, and if there was a girl in their party, Santa would look at her and pretend he was having a heart attack, falling back against his cushion and moaning with a combination of pleasure and pain. Slowly, he'd come out of it saying, "Elf, Elf, are you there?" "Yes, Santa, I'm here." "Elf, I just had a dream that I was standing before the most beautiful girl in the world. She was right here in my house." "It wasn't a dream, Santa," I'd say. "Open your eyes, friend. She's standing right before you." "Heavenly day," he'd say to the child. "You are the most beautiful creature I have seen in 617 years. I don't know where he got that figure from, but he stuck to it all night. After scooping the kid into his lap and flattering every aspect of her character, he gestured toward the mother, asking, "Is that your sister I see standing in the corner?" "No, that's my mom." Santa would call the woman over and ask if she's been a good mother. "Do you tell your daughter that you love her? Do you tell her every day?" The women would blush and fold their hands. "I try, Santa." He'd ask the child to give her mother a kiss, and then he would bring the father into it. "The most important thing," he'd tell the group, "is to love other people as much as they love you." "But how do you know how much other people love you?" I wanted to ask. This wasn't about me, though, and I didn't dare break the spell. By the time their visits were over, many of the parents would be misty-eyed. They'd take Santa's hand and sometimes give mine a squeeze as well, saying that it was well worth the wait. A number of people opened their wallets and tried to pass Santa a few bucks. They're not supposed to accept tips, but most of them take the money and wink, tucking it into their boot. This Santa looked at the tens and twenties as if they were filthy Kleenex. Then he'd close his eyes and prepare for the next family, always fresh and never disappointing. I never heard him ask what a child wanted for Christmas. Gifts seemed not to matter. It wasn't about documentation either. At his urging, the parents laid down their video cameras and huddled in for a festival of love. I was pointer elf this afternoon, one of my favorite jobs. The pointer stands inside the magic tree, and when a party comes along, he pairs them up with an available Santa elf, who then leads them into one of the houses. The first-time visitors, not knowing what to expect, are palpably excited. Returning customers, on the other hand, can sometimes be a bit too controlling. Of all the Santas, two are black, and both are so light-skinned that with the beard and makeup, you might be hard-pressed to determine their race. Last week, a black woman got upset when, having requested a Santa of color, she was sent to Jerome. "He's not black," she later complained to one of the managers. Bridget assured her that he was indeed, and the woman said, "Well, he isn't black enough." Last time I was a pointer elf, a woman approached me and whispered, "We would like a traditional Santa. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about." I sent her to Jerome. I heard it all today. "Make sure we get a white one this year," one man said. "Last time we were stuck with a black." A woman touched my arm and mouthed, "White. White like us." The A&S Plaza around the corner has only two Santas per shift, a white one and a black one, and it's very clear-cut, white people in one line and black people in another. I get requests from both sides and say, thinking of the guy I worked with the other night, and wondering again how you're supposed to know how much other people love you, "There's only one Santa." Large groups of fifth and sixth graders came in this afternoon and tore the maze to shreds. At the end of their visit, one of the mechanical elves was missing a hand, and another had its head hanging by a couple of wires. Teenagers can take an ironic approach to Santa, but 11- and 12-year-olds, afraid that they might be seen as children, actively need to prove that they no longer believe in him. Did I do the same when I was their age, I wondered, placing the stuffed animals back on their shelf before the next group entered? They really ticked me off, these kids. It's a way I'd have felt if they'd come to my actual apartment and started throwing things around. "Hey," I'd said, "what are you doing? This place is nice." It sounds pathetic, the 33-year-old elf with his hands on his hips. But it is nice here. On a good day, it's magnificent. So when people leave dirty diapers in the penguin display and stuff their half-eaten sandwiches into the mailbox of letters, when they disrespect the dancing bears or pee into the snow, I take it personally. Santa Rob's Christmas card is a photo of himself naked with a goose pecking at his ass. Yet he felt the same way I did. It's funny how that's happened. Sure, there are people who laugh at us, who think that we're just a bunch of losers. It's hard to imagine my father saying to his friends at the country club, David? Oh, he goes by Crumpet now. Works as an elf in New York City. I'll admit it doesn't sound too good. An elf at Macy's, on the other hand. Now that's saying something. Epilogue, December 21st, 1992. The Santaland Diaries was published a few months back in the New York Press, a free newspaper that comes out once a week. Many of the people who read it have contacted me, including a fellow named Don, who teaches a remedial English course in the basement of a Manhattan housing estate, and looked me up in the phone book. He felt certain that his students would enjoy my story and invited me to sit in as they read it. They'd be nervous if they knew beforehand that you were the author, so we'll tell them you're here to observe my teaching style, he said, adding that at the end of the session, he'd reveal my true identity. Yesterday afternoon, I showed up as planned and was introduced as James, a PhD candidate from Columbia University. Copies of Santaland were distributed to the students. Then Don said, Eddie, would you like to start? Eddie, a 22-year-old with tattooed hands and razor-nicked eyebrows, began. Is green. Sound it out, Don said. Come on now, Eddie, you can do this. It took well over an hour to complete the reading. Don congratulated the group on a job well done, then folded his arms and leaned back in his chair. All right, he said. So if you could meet the person who wrote this, what would you ask? The guy next to Eddie put up his hand. I'd ask, yo, is you a faggot or what? In the end, I remained neither Crumpet nor David, but just James, the gawking, unwanted visitor from Columbia University.
The Santaland Diaries were written and read by David Sedaris. The producer was Steve Doherty, and it was a Giddy Goat production for the BBC.
The first time I read excerpts from the diary there, it was at a place in New York called The Kitchen, and I was on a bill with a couple of other people, and the people in the audience were sort of all downtown people, right? Painters, and even they laughed. So I thought, if even they seem to like this, maybe... And I recently tried to turn that into an essay. It didn't work at all. I tried to turn it into an essay, but it was more about what my life was like outside of work, because I was an elf for 2 years. And the second year, my mother died 2 weeks before the season started. So you're sitting there seeing mothers all day. That's just you're seeing mothers, and you're seeing a lot of lousy mothers, or a lot of mothers who are manipulative in a way that my mother wasn't. And my drinking was really out of control then, so I was going in with hangovers. And in the essay, it was more about my life outside of... And I read it out loud, and it didn't really work. And then this young woman was in the audience, and I said, and I normally wouldn't do this to anybody, but I said, gosh, I didn't feel really good about that essay that I read tonight. And she said, it was way too long, and it's stuff we already know. And I said, thank you so much. That's exactly what the problem is.
This is BBC Radio 4 Extra, and you're listening to Being David Sedaris with me, Emma Freud, and my guest, David Sedaris. David, we're going to have another little dip into your early archive. This is a piece that you recorded when you lived in France from 1999. This is An American in Paris. Do you remember that?
Vaguely.
Why did you want to live in France? You couldn't
Hugh,
speak the
my
language.
Boyfriend Hugh had a house in Normandy. And we were living in New York, and we would go there, you know, for a little vacation in the summer. And it was so nice living in a tiny New York apartment to then have this house. And it didn't have any electricity or running water when we first got there. So we did that ourselves. And it was just great to go to a place I had my own office. You know, I didn't have to write in the corner of the bedroom. And then, so I just wanted to spend more time there. And then we were just living in this tiny village. And I thought, well, if I want to learn the language, I need to go to school, so we'll go to Paris. But I was never a Francophile. It wasn't like I, you know, set my sights early on moving to France. I didn't think all things French were better. I just sort of wound up there.
I'm so glad you didn't think all things French are better, because your disdain about the French and their language is just one of my favorite things of my life.
Well, I went to school. You know, my problem is that I went to French school, and then I was like, oh, look, German. Oh, look, Japanese. And so my French friends were like, really? You're learning Portuguese now. You never even learned the imperfect tense. But I just get excited by things, and I don't, and like my boyfriend Hugh, he's fluent in French. If you told him he could never speak English again, he'd say, fine, I'm fine with that. So I don't, you know, other languages, like in Japanese, you can say it this way, or you can say it this way, or you can say it this way, and French is just more strict.
From 1999, this is An American in Paris.
Hugh's mother, Joan, arrived last week and will be staying with us for a month. A slim and buoyant native of Louisville, Kentucky, she is the most enthusiastic of visitors. Couldn't you just die, she asks, looking out the window of our living room. Across the courtyard, our neighbor's support tights flap on the clothesline, and Joan whispers that, oh, this is just heaven. Hugh and I left last Friday to spend the weekend in Normandy, and his mother stayed behind to wander museums and take care of our cat. Before we left, she bought a bottle of wine, and I suggested that she might want to pick up a decent corkscrew because Hugh's is worthless. Every time I use it, I wind up pushing in the cork with a screwdriver. I returned to Paris this afternoon, and shortly afterwards, Joan wandered through the door with a sack of groceries and a new corkscrew, the kind with the two prongs. Boy, you were right about that corkscrew of Hugh's, she said. I couldn't get it to do anything. I pointed out that her new corkscrew was no different than the one we already had, and she said, what are you talking about? I thought this was Hugh's corkscrew. She opened the drawer and pulled out a palm-sized plastic disc attached to a shallow coupling. This part fits over the top of the bottle, she said, but when I tried turning it towards the arrow, nothing happened. It was, for me, one of those adult moments involving a choice. Do you shrug your shoulders and leave it at that? Or do you tell the woman she spent the weekend trying to open a wine bottle with a broken knob to the dishwasher? I chose the latter, adding that the oven dials don't work that well either. Oh, she said, couldn't you just die?
Il me dit des mots d'amour,
There are, I have noticed, two basic types of French spoken by Americans vacationing in Paris, the hard kind and the easy kind. The hard kind involves the conjugation of wily verbs and the science of placing them alongside other words in order to form a sentence. If the arrangement of these words is difficult, so too is the principle that each noun has a corresponding sex that affects both its articles and its adjectives. Because it is a female and lays eggs, a chicken is masculine. Vagina is masculine as well, while the word masculinity is feminine. A necklace is a he, while a necktie is a she. See how easy they've made it for me? I spent months searching for some code and then realized that common sense has nothing to do with it. These sexes were assigned not by nature, but rather by a blind monkey pulling slips of paper from a top hat. Learn the vocabulary, and then there's a question of pronunciation, and whether to address your listener as you, or the more formal yous, a title suggesting both double vision and sheep. In my struggle to master respectable French, I have exhausted two reputable teachers, and tormented untold others to the point of tears. Were the language made of meat, it's clear that I would be a butcher rather than a chef. The second, less complicated form of French is something I know so well I could probably teach it. Involving no mutilations of the lip or working knowledge of the sexes, it amounts to screaming English at the top of your lungs, much the same way as you'd shout at a deaf person or the dog you thought you could train to open beers. If English is your native language, you'll find the mechanics of easy French are quite simple. The number one rule is to raise your voice, speak slowly, and carefully enunciate, making sure to avoid any sheepishness or slight hint of apology. Doubt and hesitation are completely unnecessary, as easy French is rooted in the premise that, if properly packed, the rest of the world could fit within the city limits of Houston, Texas. Arrogant and efficient, the beauty of this language is that it allows the speaker to make several points at once. One, I won't be needing the bit it. And two, I have and will continue to prosper without the verb être. Living between the popular attractions of Notre Dame and the Pantheon, I hear a great deal of easy French thundering from the cafes lining the surrounding streets and boulevards. Two for non-smoking is met, as it should be, with great peals of carefree laughter. If you don't want to smoke, then fine, I heard one waiter say. I will make your table the non-smoking section. He pocketed the ashtray and listened as the couple moved on to another American obsession, that being our God-given right to enjoy specific quantities of frozen water. I want a Coke without too much ice, was followed by, I'll take mine with a lot of ice, but only if it's crushed. Shaved or cubed, the subject tends to generate a great deal of anxiety. Too much ice, and the son of a bitch is obviously trying to rip us off. Too little, and they're clearly holding out on us. The couple's drinks arrived, and they stared into their glasses, each of which contained a single cube no larger than a suppository. Next time we're going to San Francisco, the man yelled. They've got cable cars and ice. As with ordering one steak tartare well done and demanding a hotel room with a view of two conflicting landmarks, easy French is also used for asking directions. One afternoon, while returning home from the movies, I saw a visitor fan himself with a map and open the door to the corner bakery, shouting, "How much further to the nearest department store?" When the baker's ears eventually stopped ringing, he pointed down the boulevard, saying, as best he could, that there was a department store located 12 blocks away. 12 blocks! The man's uvula flapped in the gale force of his voice. But that's too far away! My wife's feet are tired enough already! He gestured towards a distraught-looking woman who had removed one of her tennis shoes and was in the process of massaging a foot as pale and bloated as a canned ham.
"We want a closer department store," she screamed. "Close, not far, but close."
The baker shrugged and the couple turned away, irritated by his lack of cooperation. They were apparently from some place where, upon request, small business owners will move six-story buildings from one place to the other in order to satisfy the demands of passing strangers. Then, too, was a young man who jumped in line at the neighborhood grocery store, waving a 500-franc note and shouting that he needed something smaller in order to call his mother back home in some perfect, friendly little town where the shopkeepers are more than willing to break a $100 bill without purchase. The cashier gave him 50 francs worth of coins and several bills, which he then handed back, saying, "I need change for all of it because my parents are divorced." He moved his hands as if he were breaking an imaginary marriage against his knee. "Divorced," he yelled. "They live in different places, and if I call my mother, I have to call my father as well, or else he gets jealous." The cashier apologized, explaining that she could tender no more change, and the young man turned to his companion, saying, "Didn't I tell you they were all bitches?" There are countless gentler examples of easy French in action, but I tend to embrace the more barbaric instances as they allow me to feel superior. I want a reward for my pitiful grasp of the language and find that, rather than actually studying, it's easier just to settle back and judge myself against those unfortunates who can't even ask for a bathroom without pointing at their laps. I'd been going to school for 5 months when my father came to visit me in Paris. He'd been in my apartment for all of 5 minutes when, hoping to impress him with my French, I picked up the phone, dialed a non-existent friend, and pretended to engage in serious conversation. "Yes, Regine, I am I, David. Ashtray and lamp, many pillow and chair, more ashtray and table who cost much money. I be certain mad radio for my map of neighborhood today." "That was Regine," I said to my father, after re-cradling the phone. "We're having a little political argument, but it'll blow over in a day or two." "No, it won't," he said. He hadn't understood a word, but still it was comforting to know that his total lack of support transcended any language barrier. On the first night of his visit, we joined some French-speaking American friends for dinner in a fashionable restaurant. The first course had been completed when it was decided that we could use another bottle of wine. "I've got it," my father said, and in his best easy French, he snapped his fingers, shouting, "Hey, sport, how's about another bottle of vino?" "See," he said, "that's all you have to do. They know what you're saying." This was his way of suggesting that all my efforts had been for nothing, that, like carving into stone tablets or applying leeches to an open wound, the French language was both archaic and needlessly time-consuming. Unlike me, who cowers and carefully rehearses each exchange with the butcher or dry cleaner, my father's complete lack of fear allowed him to enjoy a Paris I have never known. On the off occasions when someone failed to understand him, he'd simply repeat his question in Greek, figuring that one foreign language was just as good as another. I kept waiting for someone to publicly flog him, but it never happened. People smiled at my father the way they never do at me. I thought he might need me as a guide, but he went alone wherever he liked and even managed an exchange at a department store, an activity that, to my mind, would require at least 4 years of study. He stayed with me for 10 days, during which time I was plagued by a growing sense of envy. The French government was this close to featuring his profile on airmail stamps when he finally packed his suitcase and handed over my spare key. "There's no need to see me to the airport," he said. "I'll just take the bus or maybe the train. It'll give me a chance to meet a few more people and maybe have some laughs. I walked him down to the courtyard where the building's guardian, a small, tightly wound bundle of animosity, stood glaring at the dozens of beer bottles I had earlier tossed into the bin reserved exclusively for paper. My father greeted him with his standard, "Hi there, Chief," and the man rushed to open the heavy wooden carriage door leading to the street. He seemed confused by my father's parting words, and while I wanted to help him out, I knew that a literal translation of "keep your nose clean" would only have hurt the man's feelings. I toyed with a variety of possible French pleasantries, but watching my father disappear into the distance, I found that the words were suddenly lost to me. We stood there quietly until the silence became oppressive, and then, in my best lousy French, I excused myself and went back upstairs to sulk.
That was an edition of An American in Paris from 1999. The producer was Steve Doherty. That guy seems to get everywhere. It was very nice to have you here. Thank you very much indeed for being here, for being David Sedaris, for being honest, for being funny and for being real. Being David Sedaris was produced by Steve Doherty, and it was a Giddy Goat production for BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Indeed it was.
The Radio 4 comedy show about incredible truths and barely credible lies.
Studies regularly show Scottish people to be the happiest in the world, largely because researchers don't understand sarcasm.
With panellists including Frankie Boyle, Jack D, Zoe Lyons, Sindhu V and Henning Vane.
I mean, that is so surreal, it's got to be true because you just couldn't make that up.
Well, Zoe can.
The Unbelievable Truth returns under lockdown with your host, David Mitchell.
Yeah, that's true.
Yes!
Yeah, that's true.
Available now on BBC Sounds.